Today I will speak of still a further generalization, which apart from computations to start with, uses the same method as the one which were used in particular in the unpolarized case to prove this global existence, which is a case where I couple the Einstein equation with the Maxwell and Higgs field. In fact, the reduction of such equations in the case of one Killing field has been known for some time. First, in the case where this Killing field was time-like, so generalize the so-called Ernst equation to the case of only one Killing field, and then by Vince himself, in the case of space-time Killing field, he obtained the equation in somewhat, of course, other notations, because he's a fan of Hamiltonian reductions, which is not my own cup of tea. So, but anyways, that's about equivalent. But then I was interested, of course, in looking at global existence for such solutions. And though I didn't completely complete the program, just because of my laziness, I hope that someone in the audience will do the work that I have not done. And in fact, what are the idea is simple. In fact, it rests, to start with the so-called Kaluza-Klein reduction, which is well known to have, when you take a five-dimensional metric, which admits one space-like Killing field, and you write the vacuum Einstein equation for this five-dimensional metric, you find, with some tricks, the Einstein-Maxwell-Higgs equations. So that's what I have written here. You see, you have this five-dimensional metric, so you suppose that your space-time is an S1 bundle with a space-like Killing field, which I denote by d over dx4, tangent to the fiber. Then the metric decomposes as follows, a four-dimensional Lorentzian metric on the basis, and then this complementary term, where dx4 plus b is in fact the representant of S1 or U of 1 synonymous connection on the bundle, and this is a scalar factor, and this B is also one form, this time on V4. And as I said, it was, I think Kaluza and Klein supposed that they didn't have any X field, they took it constant and just dropped the equation which was bothering. But if you do it, you just obtain, I will show it later in a more larger context. And if you suppose now that this have an additional space-like Killing field, which I denote by d over dx3, which I suppose to commute with the first one, then you write your four-dimensional metric again now as a Lorentzian metric in 2 plus 1 dimension, plus a one form where A is again just a one form, it's a representant of a connection, but trivial since it's just U of 1, and then just a one form. And then, if you suppose that this is to be the metric G5 has to be invariant under this new Killing field, that means that your 2 plus 1 metric will be just defined on the base V3, and coordinates x alpha go from 0, 1, 2, A is a one form on V3, everything is defined on the basis V3. And B decomposes into a one form on V3, and something which plays the role of a scalar on V3. And of course, this is equivalent to saying that the five-dimensional manifold admits an abelian isometric group with two parameters. And it's trivial to identify the elements with So such a metric can be written as five-dimensional metric. That's a 2 plus 1 Lorentzian metric plus this quadratic form in this one forms, which are representant. In fact, small a is a representant of a connection which will you in the Lie algebra of the group, two-dimensional group, but it's trivial, so that's just a set of scalar functions. I wanted, so that trivial identification, you see that is if the original electromagnetic potential is orthogonal to the Killing field, then this mixed coefficient is zero, which simplifies, of course, the computations eventually later. So why not look at the general Kaluza-Klein equations, which, decomposition of a Riemann, of a Ricci curvature tensor, of a d-dimensional metric, which admits d minus 1 isometric group, has been done independently, more or less simultaneously, by various people, including myself. And then you do right things. And this, is it focused? Is it clear enough? It seems to me a bit vague, no? Or it's my own view? So if the group is abelian, it's much simpler. I mean, the curvature then of the connection, that is just the differential of this set. This A, M are just a set of scalar valued one forms. And then the curvature is just a differential, and is just a differential of A. I wanted eventually to do the thing for Young-Mills, but unfortunately, does not work well. I mean, you'll see in the following that some equation which admits and can be exactly integrated when it's a scalar, it does not integrate so nicely when you have a non-abelian group. So you do obtain just by straightforward, a bit involved computation, but straightforward, you obtain the various components of the Ricci tensor of the d-dimensional metric, where Mn denote the indices in the fiber. I mean, I consider trivialization of the bundle. And then alpha, beta are indices on the basis. So you see that the components, for instance, Rmn, look like wave equations in the metric of the in the Lorentzian metric of the basis, plus some source term, which are precisely both the curvature and the scalar multiplet, xi. And then this looks as a nice expression, which is a mixed component. They look like some kind of Maxwell equation. I mean, they are divergence of the product of curvature by e to the power x, where x is e to the 2x is a determinant of the scalar multiplet. So these are Maxwell-like equations. And finally, the equation which are the alpha beta component of the Ricci tensor of the d-dimensional metric, they have as first terms the Ricci curvature of the basis, and there is this rather annoying term, which is second derivative in x, and then you have source terms. And this rather bothering term, which would prevent the thing to look like nice Einstein equation on the basis with source, you get rid of it by conformally scaling the basis, the metric of the basis. So I jump to the case where n equals 3, that is your group is d minus 3 dimensional if your manifold was d dimensional. And then that has a nice property that on a three-dimensional metric, the Maxwell equations expect that the co-differential of the product of the curvature by e to the x is zero, which means precisely when it's scalar, that's what does not work if it would be a Young-Mills field, because there that would be the covariant gauge derivative. then it means that the differential of the dual of this waveform is zero. Therefore, since in two dimensions the dual of a two-form is a one-form, then this means that the one-form is the differential of a scalar function plus a harmonic function. And I consider the case, the class of solution where this H is zero. That's consistent, I mean, and I tried to look at what happens if you don't take this to be zero, but you run into difficulties. In fact, it's not, estimates don't work the same. So you do that, and then of course, that just definition of what is called the twist potential, in fact that's here a set of scalar functions, and you write now that the two forms are the differential of the one form A, so they are necessarily closed, and that gives you equations which are to be satisfied by these twist potentials, and these are equivalent to this type of wave-like equations. So that's why you, of course, have to do some computation to express your curvature in terms of your twist potentials. And then you do this trick that you change your metric to a conformal metric, e to the 2x, where e to the 2x is the determinant of the scalar multiplet. And using this, you get the nice property that you eliminate this second order term in x in the equation for Einstein equations. And also, when you do that, you find that the equations, remaining equations, which are equations for the scalar multiplet and for the twist potentials, they are equivalent to a wave map from the base with this conformal metric into a space, which is subspace RD with a metric capital G, where I've written here the metric capital G. And in fact, that's where my laziness comes, is that I have not had the courage to compute the Riemann curvature tensor of this metric. I know that there are programs who do that automatically, so I did not do it. But look at what happens when you are in Einstein-Maxwell case, that is Mn equals 1, 2, or 3, 4 in my notations. So that's fairly easy. And in fact, both Vince and Thibaut Damour made me remarked that this metric is just the product of the line by the Poincaré plane. Not quite obvious when you see it that way, but in fact, Vince knew it. I don't know how he knows many things. I don't know where, how he gets them. But Thibaut explained to me using Iwasawa decomposition of the metric that you put it under the form of the metric of product of a line by the Poincaré plane. So, okay. And of course, if myself had looked at the case where there are no non-diagonal terms, and then that is it. And then, so you see, you make a compendium of the wave map of these two equations for these sets of functions as another form notation, that's just notation, gauge covariant derivative, gauge covariant wave equation for the mapping U. And then you remark that this combination of Einstein equations, d-dimensional vacuum Einstein equation, they are equivalent to, they are identical to the Ricci tensor of the conformal metric G tilde equal to the what corresponds to the stress energy tensor of the wave map. That's straightforward to see. So we are now left with the same thing that we had before, which is an Einstein wave map, coupled Einstein wave map, Cauchy problem. It's what problem I'm looking to. So here is a metric written in usual Cauchy adapted frame, and the extrinsic curvature is as always derivative of G minus some Lie derivative of the shift nu. and you split it into a traceless part and a trace, and you already know that in three dimensions, Einstein equations are essentially non-dynamical, that is, they will be essentially, but not quite, as is well known, equivalent, well, I think there also Vince was the first to stress that it was not quite equivalent, the equivalent to constraints. So what you do, you use conformal method to solve the constraints, which are the ones which were written this morning by Igor, but here there is a right-hand side, which is the energy of the wave map, well, the density of energy of the wave map, and here the so-called momentum constraint, which is written also in familiar form. And to solve this constraint, as usual, you take tau equals constant, you suppose a G conformal to some metric sigma. In fact, what you don't solve that as constraint initially, you solve this constraint on each T, on each surface sigma T. I suppose that the manifold V3 is product of a surface two-dimensional by R, and sigma T denotes the surface at time T, which belongs to R. So you take the CMC gauge, and then you have the momentum constraint separates, I mean, does not, conformal factor does not appear in the momentum constraint. It just reads like the divergence of the trace free part equals some source, which is written here. And of course, such a linear equation for H is classically solved by as a sum of a solution of the homogeneous equation plus a particular solution, and the particular solution, look at it in the orthogonal to the kernel of the adjoint operator, that is, here you look for R, well, that's like in the usual conformal setting, you look for, so Q will be a solution of the homogeneous system, that is what is called a TT tensor for traceless TT, what is TT? What is the other T? Divergence free and traceless tensor satisfying these two equations, and R is a conformal derivative of a vector X, and when you bring it back here, you obtain an elliptic equation for R. So you are in that way. And looking now for the Hamiltonian constraint, it looks like a nonlinear, that's the only nonlinearity in the solution of the constraints. You find a nonlinear equation for the conformal factor when sigma is known, which is written here. And of course, like for all nonlinear elliptic equations, the signs are fundamental to find global solutions. So here how it looks, just straightforward to see. So you have first a positive term with e to the 2 lambda, then you have this P minus P2, which is positive, so that is monotonous, and then you have this minus 1 half P3, and P3 is the Riemann curvature of your conformal metric, sigma, which is supposed at present to be given, minus du square, so you see that the sign of R of sigma will play a fundamental role in solving this equation. And now I finish with this elliptic system by looking at the equation for the lapse, satisfied due to the choice of conform of CMC gauge, and the equation for the shift, which results from the definition of K. So you see, then when sigma, this conformal metric, Q, this TT tensor, and the mapping U are known on V3, you have an elliptic system for this various quantities on each sigma t. So finally, you have an hyperbolic elliptic, semilinear system, given sigma and q. And the Bianchi identity shows that when you have solved this hyperbolic elliptic system, you have not completely solved the Einstein equation. You have only solved the space part of Ricci minus the source rho. You have it results from the Bianchi identity that this space part is a TT tensor on sigma t. So here things depending on the topology. I now suppose that sigma is compact, though it would be an interesting problem to look at 2 plus 1 asymptotically Minkowskian, but I don't really know what does that mean in 2 plus 1 asymptotically Minkowskian. And in fact, so we're studying, and in fact this follows what we did with Vince in the case where of pure Einstein. We consider then sigma compact, and then what is not, we have just said that we have an hyperbolic analytic system given sigma and q. So how are determined sigma and q? Sigma is a conformal metric on the two-manifold capital sigma, and q is a TT tensor, that is a tangent to the space of metrics which have a given Riemann curvature. So to look at the evolution of this possible conformal structure, let us jump to the case where we will have results, that is the case where the genus of sigma is greater than 1. I'd like to stress that in the global existence theorems we heard of this morning, Kleinermann, Christodoulou, and now the new theorems by Roniansky and Lindblad, the global existence relies on the fact of the decay at time infinity due to decay in space. And you then have this approximately killing Minkowski fields. In case of a compact manifold, we do not have this property. We will also get decay of the energies, which will give finally this global existence for small data. But this decay there is due to the expansion. You have compact space, and the expansion will, and this expansion is obtained, will be obtained for, and also we have seen it already, and that plays a role in solution of the elliptic equation for, non-linear elliptic equation for lambda, that R of sigma is negative. Since R of sigma is negative, it means, due to the Gauss-Bonnet formula in since sigma is two-dimensional, that the genus of sigma should be greater than 1. And one can take it to be equal to minus 1. And then we are interested in the class of conformally equivalent metric on sigma, since the sigma precisely is the metric to which the metric we are looking for will be conformal. So it is known, it has been known for some time, and it has been studied in particular by Arthur Fischer and Tromba, that the space of classes of conformally equivalent metrics and sigma is called the Teichmuller space, and it can be identified with the space of metrics with scalar curvature minus 1 modulo the space, the group of diffeomorphism of a topic to the identity. And moreover, this is a trivial fiber bundle which can be endowed with the structure and the basis can be which is Teichmuller space, can be endowed with the structure of a manifold R G minus 6, where G is the genus. Here is the genus of sigma. So the problem will be to study the evolution of this metric sigma with the time. And how do we get such an equation? We get it precisely because we have not solved Einstein equation. We have, D-dimensional equation. We have said that we have solved them up to the fact that we know, only know that the space part of the Ricci tensor of the basis minus the source is a TT, transverse traceless. And this writing, that this transverse traceless is zero, is just writing that it is L2 orthogonal to all other transverse traceless tensors. And there are 6G minus 6 such tensor fields on a manifold of genus 6G minus 6. So that's how we get, writing this integral vanishing, the vanishing of this L2 scalar product on space, we do obtain differential equations, ordinary differential equations with respect to T for the conformal metric sigma T. So we are finally left with an hyperbolic elliptic system plus a differential system, or ordinary differential equations, for the conformal structure. And this, well, these are all well-posed equations, and also they nicely work well together. I mean, you solve the elliptic equations. You know that when you solve an elliptic equation, second-order elliptic equation, you gain two orders of derivatives over the coefficients, and you can solve them without any problem in the space WP. Here, it turns out that we have to use WP3 for the elliptic unknowns, and then we have to study the wave map, and the wave map we give only well, in hyperbolic equations of second order, you get one derivative bonus when you solve it, but and then we solve it in. So here is the local existence theorem. So the Cauchy data are arbitrary C infinity metric entity tensor on sigma, and then the wave map initial data, which are in H2 for the map, H1 essentially for its time derivative. And then, of course, the other unknown, they are solution of elliptic equations. You don't have to give any initial data. So that's the initial data. And then given this initial data, you determine everything. That is, first, eventually, you determine the initial value of the elliptic unknown, conformal factor, n, lapse, and nu, the shift. And they are in these spaces, continuous, differentiable in T, and taking their value in space, WP3, WP2 depends, and P must be between 1 and 2. N should be positive, and the initial, well, the, all this system you can solve by iteration, for instance, is solving one and then bringing it into the other. Derivatives, the order work fine, and then you obtain solution for small enough time, of course. So you have a corresponding unchanged space-time if there is some integrability condition, because you have solved it for the curvature F, and you have to determine A. So you have some integrability condition if your bundle is not trivial. But that's just an initial condition, so it's not a problem. And now, well, the scheme for global existence is the same as it is always. That is, since you have worked with estimates, several spaces, in fact, the proofs for the general case I'm saying manifold with GP
stick this back on.
Thank you. The proofs are essentially the same as in the vacuum case studied by Moncrief and myself. And the only thing which I didn't really check, as I said before, is that like it is in fact for wave maps, as I was told, Terence Tao was studying wave maps, proving global existence in negative curvature. Here also, it's essential when you do your proofs that your target should be of negative curvature. So as I said, I have not checked for the general metric I wrote that it is as a negative curvature, though I would guess that problems originating from geometry and physics being usually nice, that should be the case. Anyway, so the scheme for global existence, that's essentially the same. And in order to follow my usual way of thinking. The parameter time tau was the mean curvature of my slices sigma. Tau increases due to conventions of curvature from minus infinity to zero if the spacetime expands from a Big Bang to a moment of maximum expansion. As I could have remarked before, the constraint shows that this moment of maximum extension cannot be attained if r of g is zero. That's trivial on the equation of constraints. So there is hope that there will be global existence. Of course, that just has to be proved. And, the existence, but to be consist, as I said, I will take the parameter t to be minus 1 over tau. So t would vary from t0 to plus infinity. It is somewhat simpler for me to follow my thought when I look at global existence from t0 to infinity than from minus infinity to 0. So that's why here I said t0 to infinity. That's in fact before I said that parameter time tau, I will put tau equals minus 1 over t. And this existence will result from a priori bound of the norms appearing in local existence theorems. Okay. And these estimates are two kinds of estimates. You have to make elliptic estimates, easy to do for the linear elliptic equations, a bit more difficult for the nonlinear one, which is the equation in lambda, and then you have to make estimates for the wave map. But when you make all these computations, you have all your equations are written with the metric sigma. Sigma, which depends on t, and which is itself to be determined. So you have, when you have made these estimates, you have to check that your metric sigma t, well, at least that's a way of looking at it, that all these metric sigma t are uniformly equivalent. So all your norm, all the Sobolev norm that you write normally in your metric sigma, which appears in your equation, they are all equivalent. So that's why you have to go back to the differential equation satisfied by sigma, and you have to estimate to look if sigma, in fact, remains in a compact domain of Teichmuller space. And for that, we already in the polarized case, we saw that the estimates we had obtained with the energy estimates for the wave map were not sufficient to prove that the coefficient of this differential equation satisfied by sigma will be integrable. So we had to find the decay of these energies. And we were stuck for some time to that. Until I think Lars quoted that he had seen somewhere something about these corrected energies, which enabled us to find the final answer. So just let me give a brief account of these estimates. So, the first energy, in fact, it's a bit of a trick, but convenient, that instead of using just the energy of the wave map, which will be the integral over sigma t of square of space derivatives and time derivative of u, we add this traceless part of h, because then we can use the Hamiltonian constraint and obtain bound of this derivative of E.
Is this modified energy then?
No. That's just a general relativity. That's not the modified energy. That just modified energy is general for any, you can write it for any wave equation. While this is specific to, you use the constraint there. You use Einstein Hamiltonian constraint You don't use the wave map. You use Einsteinian Hamiltonian constraint to see that this is equivalent to that. And then you use the Gauss-Bonnet formula, and you derive it and make some manipulation, and you find that the derivative of the energy is given by this term, that is tau, which was this mean extrinsic curvature, which is a negative, and this positive quadratic form, but not positive definite. But this is negative of zero. So E, the first energy, is a non-increasing function of T, whatever that's due to the Hamiltonian constraints that's special to, as you know, things are special to general relativity. They don't. Yeah. So that's, but that's not increasing, but that cannot be used to obtain decay because there is no square of space derivative there. And then, well, you have to go back and forth between hyperbolic and elliptic. So here I code the first elliptic estimates, which are trivial, in fact. They just, well, the definition of E, of course, gives that H is bounded in L2. If lambda is bounded, then you have by the maximal principle, and now sigma equal minus 1, and the equation of the shift, you obtain these preliminary bounds, which are easy to see. Now, if you want to use the equations more in detail to obtain elliptic estimates, you need to bound their coefficients, and the coefficients are essentially quadratic in the wave map. So you have to, well, you have to, and maybe yeah, there are other possibilities, but a way is to go to, these would be L4 bounds, you have to go to H2 for U. So we will be able to bound this quantity in WP1 with P between 1 and 2 in order to have elliptic estimates once you have obtained a bound of the second energy of the wave map. And then, as before for Einstein equations, for wave map, we have to use geometrically well-chosen quantities. If you would just consider any semilinear wave equation, we will not have the good bounds. So we use the quantities linked with the geometry of the wave map. That is, we define the second energy to be the wave, the gauge covariant Laplacian of U plus the gauge covariant derivative of the time derivative of U to define E. That's where we will need eventually the negative curvature to prove that these norms are in fact equivalent to H2 norm analysis. Because this is just the square of the gauge covariant Laplacian. So if we want to bound the second derivative, we have that where I use the Riemann negative curvature. So, well, that's just definition of epsilon, the square and tau minus 2. In fact, this is product of T square by E1 of T, that's what will be bounded, and that E of T. And then computations and estimates, and elliptic estimates, one obtains bounds for the conformal factor and the lapse, supposing, as often one does in this type of studies, we suppose a priori that these energies are bounded and that sigma remains in a compact subset of Teichmuller space, and modulo this hypothesis, we obtain further bounds. And then, using these bounds, one obtains this equation differential equality for this second energy. And what is interesting is that we do have this term, minus 2 tau E of 1, that's why we have this better behavior of E1 than E. And then we have tau, which is negative, and that which is positive, with the same problem as before, that is, it does not contain square or space derivative. Plus here, of course, it's not exact. We have a remainder, but the nice point is that this remainder is of this type. That is 1 over t cube, and here is the cube of the energy. That's why, by bootstrap argument, using small energies, we'll obtain, finally, bounds, global bounds. But as I said, these are not enough to obtain decay of the energies which are necessary to brought back into the elliptic equations which determine the conformal structure sigma, shows that this remains in a bounded, in a compact set of Teichmüller space. So that's where one introduces corrected energies. And in fact, the corrected energies comes from the fact that we didn't have, there was a missing part in the right-hand side, which was the square of the space derivatives. But we had a positive square of time derivatives. So the idea is to take a bit of this positive part of time derivative to transform it into a square of space derivatives in order to get something which is decay. So the idea of corrected energy, though I don't really know where they were used first, is that you define the corrected energy, first energy to be the original energy minus a complementary term, where you take here the mean value of your map onto sigma t with respect to the measure mu sigma. And we do something analogous for the second corrected energy, and here you correct it also. But here it's in a sense easier because you correct it, you don't have to take any mean, you correct it by product of. So you see, when you will derive that, you will here using the Poincaré inequality, obtain, take off some part of u prime square and get some part of du square, and here also, after some manipulations. So you do that, and you use all your elliptic estimates, and of course the estimates you obtained before for E and E1, and then you obtain nice differential inequalities for these E and E alpha of 1. I notice that here, that should be less or equal. I don't know why I put plus. That's less or equal than that. So you have some work to do. You have to check that your corrected, if you bound your corrected energies, you have bounded your original energies. So you have to show that this sum is equivalent to total energy you had before. And then that depends, in fact, on the first positive eigenvalue of the Laplacian of sigma. And, using all these differential inequalities, you finally obtain a bound of the total energy at time t with a small t to the minus k, where k is a positive number, equal to 1 when this eigenvalue is greater than 1/8, between 0 and 1 in the other case. And this capital M depends only on the a priori bound on total energy and domain of sigma that you had before. So, of course, this you're done. I mean, when you have such an inequality, you know that by bootstrap argument, for small data, you will obtain global bounds. So you have global bounds of your energy and global decay, and then global bound of sigma in a compact domain of your space, your Teichmüller space, and then you obtain this global existence theorem. So the data are this conformal metric C infinity and transverse stressless tensor in sigma zero, also C infinity, and then Cauchy data for the wave map, some integrability condition in the sense of fiber bundles in order to be able to compute the connection in terms of curvature. And of course, all that supposes that the genus of sigma zero is greater than one. And then you find that the total energy at initial time is less than some number, positive number eta. Then the four-dimensional Einstein Maxwellic system has a solution on for all parameters t. You can prove that this is globally hyperbolic and Fletcher time-like and null complete. And as I said, the conjecture that is true for arbitrary Kaluza line with abelian group, but I wait for someone to compute the curvature. Thank you.
Just a comment. I think it's known that these wave maps take their values in symmetric spaces of the form non-compact over maximal compact subgroup. And that means that the sectional curvatures are negative. I mean, I think in this case it's probably SL k plus 1 over SO k, where k is the number of killing fields.
Okay, I'm glad. Thank you.
For large data, is there any known obstruction for putting that?
No, precisely not. There is no obstruction. That's why. No, there is no obstruction. Vince would tell you that black holes cannot form when there is one killing field.
Right.
But I'm not sure that he really. That he is sure of that.
He feels there shouldn't be
black holes when there is a translation killing field.
There is a theorem like this in the asymptotic very black. A heuristic argument.
Yeah. Well, he certainly has an argument, heuristic at least, because he does not just speak. As you said, of course, a polarized case adjusts Einstein coupled with a scalar field. But 2 plus 1 Einstein with scalar field, it's however very, very, very coupled, yeah. Very nonlinear. So, but maybe, sure, maybe nice.
Well, it seemed that it was easy to obtain a bound on the first energy and a lot of work to get the second one.
Yes.
So if one had an improved existence theorem,
sure.
One
would yes, that
would
be
together.
Very nice.
But
yes.
It will have to be at the level of H1, which is tough. I mean, Tay is going to tell us.
I'll tell you it's tough. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, of course. If there was, if one did not need H2, that would be, we'd be through very, very fast, yes. In fact, the only geometrical, well, the only physical quantity, that's H1. And then H2, no, a wave map, there are some simplification in the second energy, but, well, thank you.
I have one question in relation to this. So you mentioned that it's important to have the target space for the wave map to have negative curvature.
Yes.
But if you look at wave maps with spherical targets, then there are results,
yes,
at least
I've
in the flat space background, where
interesting
if you have smaller
but
energy.
Of course, we are not in that case.
Yes,
there are this, that they call co-moving or co-rotational.
Equivariant,
yes.
But also, I guess Terry has results in
this.
So, that, but I guess that's a much, much harder problem to do the corresponding situation with an expanding background and a spherical target.
But here, even with ordinary wave equation, we don't know the existence, global existence. I mean. So, wave maps, they are very interesting in themselves.
Okay, so let's thank everyone again.